Metcast, Sunday, October 11th, 2020. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the podcast. Hope you are having a wonderful week, a great weekend, and just things are going well for you, despite everything that's going on in this crazy world. Yeah, I know, things can get crazy, but, you know, hey, we're here. We've got lots of cool Apple and Mac news to get into. Stuff is happening for sure, and we now know about Apple's next event, the iPhone 12 event. So we will be getting into that, all the details there, what to expect, what we are expecting, what we are hoping they might show off for us. We're also going to talk about new Macs maybe coming before the end of the year. Yeah, some interesting news there. A lot of Apple TV Plus stuff going on. We'll dig into antitrust claims against Apple and some other companies. We got some news in that realm. Not my favorite thing to talk about. I don't like talking about this kind of legal lawsuit-y kind of stuff, but it's newsworthy, and we'll get into it in this episode. Also, a potential vulnerability on modern Macs, and one that is going to be tricky for Apple to deal with. We'll talk about that and try to waylay any fears that you might have surrounding that, because it's serious, but I think we know how we can keep ourselves protected. And then look around coming to another city. Yep, we'll get into all of that in the Apple Mac news this week. And then I have a ton of great feedback and additional comments and things to follow up on from our community. We're going to get into that fitness data loss and just have a little conversation about that. I have a tip and trick for you in using the podcast app that came via a listener question. I've got some great listener tips and feedback from the community, including a tip on iOS notes that came in from the Patreon group, the Patreon supporters, which is really cool. And we'll try to help a listener out with a cellular issue on his iPhone. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So that should be a great one. I don't want to waste any time because we do have Apple's event to talk about. So let's just jump right into that. The announcements have gone out. We know that this coming Tuesday, as I record this podcast, and maybe even by the time you hear this, Apple's event will have happened. It is the high-speed event. That was what was in the invite. They had an Apple logo with a dark blue background, a bunch of circles, and kind of orangish circles and an Apple logo. Of course, a lot of people try to read a lot of speculation into what all of that means. I don't like to do the whole tea leaves on the Apple announcement because I kind of feel like it's never really fully accurate. I guess the one thing on this one that's being floated around that I think is probably a shoe-in is that the dark blue color indicates midnight blue color iPhone. Considering we have a midnight blue Apple Watch, I don't think that's too far of a stretch. So I'm willing to buy in on that one, but maybe not some of the other things. As far as what high speed means, I think it's generally a reference to the 5G that is coming in the iPhone, along with Apple's new screaming A14 processor that's expected to be in there. We've talked a little bit about what iPhones are expected to be announced, also a little bit more about the branding. We'll just review that here real quick. We are expecting four different models of iPhone, starting with an iPhone 12 mini, and that would be some new branding on the iPhone 12, but does make sense considering Apple's kind of entire lineup of products. It's the smaller of, or smallest, I guess I should say, of the iPhone 12 lineup, the 5.4-inch model. It's expected to start at around $700, $699 US, and come in sizes of 64, 128, and 256 gigabytes. Following up with the larger size iPhone 12, the iPhone 12 6.1 inch, I expect it to start around $799 US and in the same storage sizes as the iPhone 12 mini. Then you're going to have the two Pro models, the iPhone 12 Pro coming in also at 6.1 inch on the display or on the size. Expected to start around $1,000 US, $999. And for the Pro models, you're looking at storage sizes of 128 gigabytes, 256 gigabytes, and 512 gigabytes. So I don't think any big surprises there. Of course, the iPhone 12 Pro Max, that is the big beastie phone, 6.7 inches, expected to start around $1,099 US. All of the 12 series models, I guess we should talk about cameras first. There's going to be a difference between the 12 series and the 12 Pro series. The 12 series is expected to have a dual lens camera system. The iPhone 12 Pro series models will have the triple lens camera system along with that new LiDAR technology that we first saw in the iPad Pro update. As far as other features, the phones are all pretty much expected to have the same features beyond the cameras and the phone sizes. All OLED displays this year, so every model getting OLED. 5G across the line. We've been hearing mixed reports, but the latest seems to indicate that at least in the US, you're going to have sub 6 gigahertz support along with millimeter wave. Again, this has been in flux, in debate. There's been some rumors that only the high-end iPhone 12 Pro model would get millimeter wave. Like I said, we're also heard recently that maybe only the US is going to get the millimeter wave technology. So we're going to have to wait and see what Apple does on that one at the event. The design is expected to be this new flat edge design similar to the iPhone 4 models. So a little retro styling on this year's iPhones and a nice little design change. It'll also kind of line up with the newest iPads. And we already talked about a possible new color, the Midnight Blue. It's expected to have faster Face ID technology. So Apple's actually improved that, believe it or not. I think Face ID is great. I think it works pretty well. But if they can improve it, so much the better. And then, of course, we are not expected to get any kind of charging brick or ear pods in the box this year. Apple trying to save the environment, save a little bit of money, probably to offset the added cost of the 5G technology that's going to be coming into play. And that's pretty much what we're expecting from iPhone 12 this year. So it should be a nice update. A lot of people very excited about it. There's kind of a buzz going. It's expected to do very well for Apple this year, just in terms of the iPhone upgrade cycles. So a lot of people may be looking to upgrade. Of course, Apple's probably going to have a lot of financing options along with Apple Card and, of course, the iPhone upgrade program. So that will help as well. As far as what else we are expecting, or so just some additional things that we're hearing about kind of late in the rumor cycle here, a possible revival of the MagSafe branding, but this time around the phone. You may remember a while back we talked about rumors about some circular kind of magnets built into the back of this year's iPhones, and that was expected to aid in helping line up the chargers. It sounds like Apple may have some charging options to show off for us with two new MagSafe wireless chargers, but for iPhone. I don't expect there's going to be any kind of physical connector like a smart connector. I think it's still going to be wireless charging. It's just that the charging puck, just like the Apple Watch, will sort of magnet right into place so you don't have to worry about any kind of alignment. And we're hearing about a MagSafe charger and also a potential rumor of a MagSafe Duo charger, which seems to indicate a ability to maybe charge multiple devices at once. I would think a great option would be the ability to do an iPhone and an Apple Watch at the same time. But they didn't give any details on it, just that the name would be MagSafe Duo Charger. So maybe some new chargers in line. We also got reports that Apple had filed for an iPhone for Life patent in Hong Kong, or not patent, rather trademark in Hong Kong. And that could indicate that maybe Apple's looking to rebrand the iPhone upgrade program. There was also some speculation that it just may be Apple trying to lock that phrase up, because some carriers have been using that to refer to getting iPhone upgrades. So maybe Apple just wants to control that branding a little bit. But I think we might see a rebranding of that Apple iPhone upgrade program with the iPhone for Life branding. We'll just have to wait and see. Staggered release is still something that is being rumored. Again, this is another one of those rumors that's been in flux. We've heard a bunch of different things, different ways, but it's very likely that Apple will not have all four models ready to go right after the event. Of course, we're expecting some pre-orders being available probably on the Friday following the event, and then some sort of release of iPhone models maybe the next week. The question becomes, which ones are Apple going to release first and which ones are going to be coming later, probably in November? The most recent leaks seem to claim that both the 6.1-inch models will have the earlier release date. So that means the iPhone 12 model and the iPhone 12 Pro, with a release date expected to be October 23rd. The iPhone 12 mini and the iPhone 12 Pro Max models are expected to come on November 13th and November 20th, respectively. Now, again, this is the most recent rumors we had this week. I still am in the camp where I think we could see them release the iPhone 12 models first, the 12 mini and the iPhone 12, and that followed by the Pro models. Now, that's something they've done in the past. I guess the one factor that's pushing it back towards both 6.1-inch models being released at the same time is that that could be just how they lined up their display orders. And the fact that the OLED display is the same across the devices, I would imagine there's a lot of similarities in terms of production. So maybe that is what will happen. I would welcome that because I'm hoping to get an iPhone 12 Pro upgrade, the 6.1-inch model. I am not interested, as many of you who have listened to this podcast know for a long time, in getting a larger iPhone. As a matter of fact, I'm even a little bit bummed that I have to go up to 6.1 inches because I think that's a little bit too large for my liking. I would have liked to have stayed with the 5.4-inch form factor. Of course, I could get that with the iPhone 12 mini, but that would mean sort of downgrading my camera system, which I'm not really interested in doing. So I'm going to go with the iPhone 12 Pro. We'll have to see if I get to order it in October or get to receive it in October or if I'm going to have to wait until November. As far as what other announcements Apple might make at this event, there's a few things being kind of thrown around in the rumor mill. There are reports that Apple could announce the new HomePod Mini. It's expected to be about half the size of the current Mini, so just about, I think, 3.3 inches high, so tiny little thing. I think we had heard in the past that Apple may achieve the smaller size by significantly reducing the number of tweeters in the device all the way down to 2 from 7, which is what is in the full-size HomePod. Of course, we would expect it to have the same kind of base, just a little bit smaller, probably a little bit more less volume being pumped out of it as well. So it's going to be a nice little personal desk speaker. I don't know if it'll have the ability to really fill a room. We don't know much about it. The rumors are saying it will be powered by an S5 processor. That's the same processor that's in the new Apple Watch, which is, if you remember, the current HomePod is powered by an A8 series processor, which is more of an iPhone processor. So that would be an interesting switch, but also does kind of indicate how far Apple has come with their processor technology, that they can maybe power the HomePod Mini with an Apple Watch processor. Probably the most exciting thing about this rumor, in my opinion, is the price point, because I fully expected the HomePod Mini to maybe be targeting a $199 US or maybe even $149 US price point. We're hearing in these latest rumors that Apple could be shooting for a $99 price point. And I think if they come in with a HomePod at $99, they're going to sell quite a few of them, and it's going to be a very popular device. As far as when it's going to be available, we are hearing that it'll likely be shipping in November. We don't have a hard release date on it. But another interesting thing that happened this week that seems to push us towards the fact that Apple could have a new HomePod and maybe some new headphones is that Apple stopped selling any third-party headphones or speakers on their online store. This is according to Bloomberg, some checks that they did at the end of September. So that can often be an indication that Apple's looking to push their own products. It could just be, too, that in the age of the pandemic and COVID-19 that we're in, you know, Apple store visits and those sorts of things are down a little bit, and Apple could just be clearing out and trying to simplify the lineup a little bit. We don't really know. I don't want to read too much into this, but it could be an indication that we're expecting some new audio products from Apple. The one thing that Apple is not expected to update is the original HomePod. That's going to kind of stay as is. So the HomePod Mini is just going to come in and be added. We're not expecting any changes to the existing HomePod, which has been selling, you know, probably not all that great for Apple. It's been doing okay. I don't think it's a failure by any means. I absolutely still love mine. I know a lot of people love theirs, but I do think the price point has caused it to suffer a little bit in the face of some of the other smart home speakers that are out there on the market. So I think it's a good move for Apple to bring in a lower price point option. And again, I think it's going to sell very, very well. The other audio product that we've been hearing a lot about, and we've been talking about here on the MacCast, is the new AirPods Studio over-the-ear headphones. These are the ones that are going to kind of have a retro design. It's expected they're going to have swappable materials coming in with a sport version and a higher-end sort of leather studio version. The ear cup and headband pieces are expected to be swappable, so you'd be able to kind of change out your materials so you could go between a sport look and a higher end look. And that could be also a good opportunity for kind of third parties. So ability to customize and sort of match and create your own style, which is pretty cool. Also expected to have some technology like neck detection. So sort of like the AirPods, which when you take them out of your ears, detect that you've removed it from your ear and pause the audio. This would be a similar technology for the over-the-ear headphones. You'd remove them from your head. When you put them around your neck, it could pause the music. And then when you put them back on, it could restart it. There have also been rumors that there would be head orientation detection. Again, probably to power the same kind of technology that Apple just added to the AirPods, which is AirPods Pro, I should say, which is the new spatial audio technology. So that's pretty cool stuff. The AirPods Studios are expected to be priced at around $350 US. And again, these might not be ready to ship until November. So it may be a little bit up in the air whether or not Apple chooses to announce them at this October event, because we are hearing rumors about a possible next event, and we'll get into that in just a moment. The last couple of products that we might expect at Apple's high-speed event, we think that Apple could possibly announce the new Air trackers, their item trackers, Bluetooth item trackers that we've been hearing about for a long, long time. The only fly in that ointment is Apple leaker John Prosser, who says, nope, they're not ready to go yet. They've been pushed back until March of 2021. It's been interesting because we've been hearing about the AirTags for a long, long time. We've kind of seen references in the Find My app and in the beta builds indicating that these things are something that Apple's been working on, that they should be coming. But they seem to be taking a long, long time. And for something so small, you wouldn't think that it would be that complicated of a technology. But that then makes me think and get a little bit more excited that Apple is really trying to push the boundaries here and really do something different. Because there's a lot of these trackers out on the market. They've been around for a while. Again, you wouldn't think the technology is that complex, but Apple is trying to do some stuff, we think, with the ultra-wideband chips. And if they have to push it back again until March of 2021, you can be sure they're trying to really get the user experience on these things right. So I think that's the right move. If they're not ready, if they're not doing what Apple and the engineering team thinks they need to do to be a really, truly innovative product and kind of take this space to the next level, then I think it's the right thing to hold off. But that means we may not get an announcement of AirTags at the high-speed event. The other thing that's been being thrown around is that Apple has been working on an Apple TV update. I think we talked about this a little bit in the last episode of the MacCast. One of the big bits of news here is that Apple may be looking to redesign the Apple remote. I would expect with an Apple TV update, we'd get a processor update. I don't think there'd be a huge form factor form factor change or anything, but we are hearing about a new remote, and it wasn't really clear if that meant a new Siri remote, or we've been hearing rumors that Apple is really looking at trying to take Apple TV and gaming and Apple Arcade to the next level. So they could be trying to do some sort of setup, and the remote could be more of a gaming controller that would be coupled with the Apple TV. Will we see that rumor or that release rather at this next event? I think probably not. I'm not really expecting an Apple TV update. One could be in the works, but again, it may come a little bit later. Probably early in 2021 would be my guess. But that's what we're expecting from the event. Of course, maybe by the time you are listening to this show, we will know some of the answers to these questions. Of course, we'll be following up on a episode of the MacCast not long after the event to kind of fill you in on all the actual products that Apple announced. And as I like to do, I'll probably take a couple days to come down from the reality distortion field, the excitement of the event, kind of parse through all of the information that's coming out, and we'll get deep into it and, of course, be planning our pre-orders of our new iPhones. So always fun to have an Apple event to talk about. So I'm looking forward to next week, as I imagine you are too. So, Apple has had two events so far here at the end of the year. We had the Apple Watch event, and now we're going to get the iPhone event. Guess what? We're hearing about another possible event happening before the end of the year. This is according to Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. He says that Apple is still planning an Apple Silicon Mac event, and it is suspected that Apple will be announcing their first Mac featuring Apple Silicon, their own processor design. Tim Cook mentioned during the announcement of this that Apple would be having a product by the end of the year, and so we are expecting an announcement. Having an event for it makes sense. It's just not clear at this point which model of Mac will be the first one. It is pretty much expected to be a notebook. What's not clear is, will it be a 13-inch MacBook Pro, a MacBook Air update, or a 12-inch MacBook? Ming-Chi Kuo has said the first model would be a 13-inch MacBook Pro. 13-inch MacBook Pro probably is due for an update, so that does make some sense. I think it also makes some sense, though, that maybe it is a new 12-inch MacBook. I would like to see that product. That would be a nice little update. I don't think it's going to be a MacBook Air, but that's just my gut telling me that. We will have to find out maybe in October. Also, those mentions of other products that might be available at the event this week. Yeah, AirPod Studios, Apple TV updates, those things that we are hearing might be coming out in November, they may be more appropriate to lump in with an Apple Silicon Mac event. So we could see that Apple really focuses on iPhone 12 this week and then has their audio announcements coupled with the new Mac announcement later in November to be timed closer to when those products might be available to ship. So we'll have to wait and see, but it's kind of cool this year. I mean, yeah, 2020's been weird. It's been weird for Apple. It's been weird for Apple announcements. We're not having live events. I am actually kind of liking these pre-produced events, and it makes you wonder if Apple would continue that trend moving forward even after the pandemic. I don't think they will, because they built an entire theater, the Steve Jobs Theater, to kind of have these events. And I think there's just nothing better than kind of the live announcement and the live excitement of that and being able to stream that. As much as I am enjoying these kind of pre-produced keynotes that I guess we call them keynotes that Apple's been doing. What do you think about this stuff? Do you like the new kind of pre-produced stuff, or do you really miss the old live keynotes? Again, I think they're ultimately going to go back to them when they can. But for now, this is kind of cool. And hey, we get three events at the end of the year, and that is always fun. So looking forward to the next one and potentially the next one after that. Moving on to Apple TV Plus news, Apple has been really doubling down, it seems, on the documentaries. This past week, Apple shared a teaser trailer for an upcoming Bruce Springsteen documentary set to hit Apple TV Plus on October 23rd. It will show Bruce and his full E Street Band recording live for the first time in 35 years. The doc will release at the same time as their new album, Letter to You, releases exclusively on Apple Music. Apple has also ordered a new fashion docuseries called The Supermodels for Apple TV+. It was picked up as part of Apple's First Look arrangement with Imagine Documentaries. It will cover a period starting in the 80s, and the series will dive into the careers of supermodels Naomi Campbell, Cindy Crawford, Linda Evangelista, and Christy Turlington, and it will focus on their, quote, collective disruption of the 90s fashion scene and its lasting impact through today. According to Deadline, Apple has ordered a new natural history series called Earth Sound. They have reportedly ordered 12 half-hour episodes, which will take advantage of audio technologies like 360-degree sound design to tell stories of the natural world. The series comes from the British production company Offspring Films, who is responsible for the amazing docuseries Planet Earth 2. The Morning Show has its second season tentatively scheduled to restart filming on October 19th, according to Deadline. The last two episodes were nearing completion when they were forced to shut down due to the pandemic back in March. The show has reportedly been rewritten to actually acknowledge the pandemic, something that they did with season one as well, to acknowledge the Me Too movement. So Morning Show kind of adapting to the times. They're moving back into production to kind of wrap up, and Apple trying to get their, you know, second season of a lot of their original series that they launched last year up and going again. That would also include season two of Dickinson, which actually had completed filming. We now know that that show is going to premiere on Apple TV Plus on January 8th. Apple will be doing the release a little bit different this time, releasing the first three episodes rather than all of the episodes at once, and then it will air additional episodes weekly following that. This is a trend that Apple has been doing more recently with a lot of their shows. It's a trend that, honestly, if you ask me, I'm not a very big fan of. I wish Apple would just release everything all at once, let us binge watch it. I don't know why, in the age of streaming, that streaming services are starting to do this. And we are seeing it more and more, where they're not releasing all of the content at once. I would presume that's to try and keep us coming back to the platform week after week. It probably works, but frankly, it's just really annoying, in my opinion. And I think we should have the option. We should be able to choose for ourselves. The only rationale I can think of it for, because, you know, you're paying for the streaming content, and a lot of the streaming content isn't being pushed by ads. The only reason I can think of them doing it that way is to keep you coming back to look at other shows and maybe potentially consume other shows, to kind of lock you into their service. And I guess it would work to a certain degree, but again, not my favorite thing. But that is apparently how they're going to do Dickinson this year. Apple also confirmed that the show will get a third season. I believe this is the first Apple TV Plus series to actually get a confirmed third season. And some good news if you are on the free Apple TV Plus subscription. According to reports from both 9to5 Mac and Renee Ritchie, Apple is planning to extend your free subscription through February of 2021. So if you started a free year of Apple TV Plus right on the first date, we were set to have that end at the end of this month. So November 1st would be the first time you would start to have to pay. That has been extended. So November 1st through January 31st, your trial will go to. So that means all the way through the end of January, the 1st of February. If you are on a yearly plan already or you pay monthly for Apple TV Plus, your current account is going to be credited, supposedly, for the extra 3 months. So that means you could use that credit on things like iTunes purchases, Apple Store purchases, or iCloud services. So you'll just get money back into your account. And if you're on a paid yearly plan, the rumor is that if that plan was set to renew between November and January of this year, your renewal date will be extended to the end of January or the start of February. No word on when you'll see these changes in your account. I checked in on mine and I haven't seen anything yet. And this, of course, has not been made official by Apple. So it does make me wonder if maybe they're holding out to announce this at the event on Tuesday as kind of an added bonus. And it does make sense that Apple would want to do this because, again, the second seasons of a lot of their shows aren't ready to start airing yet because of the pandemic and COVID. So they want to keep subscribers around and on the service so that when those new seasons start up, they'll be incentivized to re-up and resubscribe. So Apple just adjusting the timing a little bit to kind of match the times, and that makes a lot of sense. The last thing in kind of Apple TV Plus news is that Apple recently joined the Alliance for Creativity and Entertainment, ACE. This is according to Variety. This is a group whose mission is to fight piracy in the industry, something Apple has been behind for a very long time. It's interesting to me because I would be curious. I need to do maybe a little bit of research. Maybe someone in our community knows. I don't know that at least in many places that piracy is as rampant anymore, just because of streaming services and the kind of cost of that. Maybe it still happens. Maybe it's still going on pervasively. I don't really know. With a lot of movies not releasing this year, maybe in those channels it's ramped up a little bit. But, you know, it's something that I'm a little bit curious about. But it is good to see Apple joining this alliance. They've always been on that side of content creators and companies making sure that they get paid and compensated for their hard work, which they absolutely should. And so they have joined the Alliance for Creativity and Entertainment. And with that, that's it for the Apple TV Plus news for the week. Now, as I kind of alluded to at the top of the show, we got to talk a little bit about one of my not favorite things, and that is kind of some legal stuff. Well, this one really is government regulations. A U.S. antitrust report claims that Apple and others do have, quote, monopoly power. In a 450-page document, the Democratic Subcommittee on the U.S. House Judiciary shared its recommendations on changes to antitrust laws that they feel would prevent anti-competitive practices by big companies like Apple, Alphabet, which is Google, Amazon, and Facebook. The report comes after a 16-month investigation into the business practices of these companies. According to the report, the subcommittee feels that these companies, including Apple, are taking advantage of their, quote, monopoly power to prevent competition. The report makes some recommendations, including the possibility of breaking up some of these companies into smaller companies. So in Apple's case, this could be, imagine the scenario of Apple being forced to break off the App Store into a completely separate company. The App Store is kind of the piece of Apple's business that's really come under scrutiny. A lot of folks feeling that Apple is kind of using that to control the marketplace, using their App Store rules and guidelines. We've heard a lot about that this year. Another recommendation of the committee was to offer consumers an easier way to transfer data from one company to another, so to be able to switch from one service to another. I could imagine in Apple's scenario and also in the case of Google and some of these other companies, that would mean being able to take your apps with you maybe. It might be something that they would be considering to be able to move cross platforms. I don't know that they could necessarily force that, but the point is is Apple and these companies are now facing potential government regulation because of these findings and really the commission feeling that they have monopoly power. We don't know what's going to happen. Really, this was just a report and some recommendations. We'll have to wait and see if any action actually comes out of this. In a statement after the release of the report, Apple said they vehemently disagree with the findings of the commission. They also made comments that they are really focused on the opportunities the App Store creates for developers and the economy, pointing out that they do not have a dominant market share in any category where they do business. So in Apple's mind, they are not a monopoly. They don't have a monopoly, and they obviously disagree with the report. Apple, of course, has come under fire on many fronts for its App Store practices lately, and we heard from some folks who would be in the know recently about this stuff. Former App Store director, and this all came out through the report, I should point out, and statements made in the report. So, like I said, that 450-page document is available if you want to take a look at it. But in that document, former App Store director, Phil Shoemaker told the Congressional Antitrust Committee that he feels Apple uses the App Store rules as a, quote, weapon against competitors. He pointed to Apple Arcade as an example, since it's an App Store within an App Store, something that Apple does not allow other apps or services like Xbox Game Pass to do. They have not allowed that. They have not allowed Facebook gaming on the App Store. So this seems to be in direct contradiction to Apple's own rules. Also in that report, the CEO of ProtonMail, Andy Yen, compared Apple's business practices around encouraging developers to implement in-app purchases to mafia-like extortion. His example was that ProtonMail was a free app in the App Store tied into their mail service. It had been running along fine in the App Store for years when Apple suddenly decided that they needed to offer in-app purchases as an option. Now, what triggered this was some of the same things that have triggered this rule for some other apps. It was that ProtonMail was advertising their paid-for service, or had a reference, I guess you should say, advertising might be a little bit strong, but had a reference to their paid upgraded service in the app, something that was a violation of Apple's App Store guidelines. And having that in there meant that you either needed to remove that or offer up in-app purchase options for the paid-for service. Ultimately, ProtonMail added in the in-app purchase option begrudgingly, and they really did feel pressured, according to the statements made by the CEO. Later on, Apple did change this rule to not apply to email apps, but ProtonMail still has the in-app purchase option because they say they're afraid of retribution from Apple should they remove it at this point. So, you know, there have been debates about this. I've heard from developers both ways. Some feel very oppressed and sort of controlled by Apple's rules, and others feel that it's totally fine, that Apple has defined them clearly, applies them evenly, and if you want to be in the App Store, this is just the rules for doing business, and they're okay with it. So, you know, we've kind of heard both ways, but Apple obviously under scrutiny in recent times. Overall, though, the App Store, to Apple's point, does create some pretty good revenue opportunities for developers, and some of the latest data from App Annie seems to support that. We talked, I think, last time on the MacCast about some numbers generating about $18 or $19 billion in revenue over the last quarter. The numbers from App Annie seem to support that. They say that iOS app downloads have increased 20% year over year in the third quarter, and that app spending also grew 20%, generating $18 billion. So the numbers seeming to line up. App Store doing very, very well. Some of that being attributed to more people working from home, people being isolated and probably trying to download and play a lot more games on their iOS devices, which helps run up revenue. But there is no doubt that that is good for developers. It's good for the App Store. It's good for Apple. The question then becomes, is Apple a little bit too controlling of that environment? And obviously, that's looking to be sorted out. I think Apple would probably prefer to do anything they have to avoid government regulation. We'll just have to wait and see how all this plays out. Sounds like Apple has a little bit of an issue with its T2 security chip, and unfortunately, this is something that Apple may not be able to fix. A team of jailbreakers has claimed to have found a vulnerability that could allow a hacker to circumvent the T2's disk encryption, firmware passwords, and verification chain. They used a technique based on a jailbreak hack that was used on Apple's A10 processor, which is a design similar to the design of the T2 chip, or the design upon which the T2 chip was based. The hack apparently jacks into the boot process of the T2's SEP OS, and normally, if you attempt to decrypt anything during this boot process or while it's happening, the T2 chip will exit with a fatal error. This exploit apparently allows a hacker to basically bypass that. Once booted, the attacker would have full root access and kernel execution privileges on the T2 chip. They do not have the ability to decrypt files stored using File Vault 2 encryption, so just another good reason to use that feature if you're not already using it on your T2-equipped MacBook Pro or MacBook. But they could potentially, because they have that root access, install something like a keylogger or additional software to gain access to your system or to access additional information. On the plus side, I guess if you can say there's a plus side, this is not a persistent vulnerability, so it's not clear if they'd be able to maintain that access after a reboot, a full reboot of the system. Probably not, and you would actually need to re-implement the hack or have something physically attached to regain that access every time the system is rebooted. And because the T2's operating system is stored in the read-only memory, the ROM, it's not something that is really able to be patched by Apple. So this vulnerability will exist. Apple apparently had been notified about the vulnerability multiple times and failed to respond, according to the reports, which is why this information is being released publicly now. They are likely planning, at least internally at Apple, to address this in future updates to the T2 chip and the hardware, so they can patch the software and the ROM, of course, in future chips, but all the T2 chips that are out there currently would be potentially vulnerable to this exploit. So now the question becomes, do we really have to worry about this thing? How much of a threat is it? I would say to the average person, probably not much of a threat. As noted, you do need physical access to the machine. You would need the ability to actually connect a physical device to the machine to implement the hack. So as long as you're in full control of your device, you're probably okay. Also, like we noted, it's not a persistent vulnerability. So even if a hacker had temporary access, they would only have access during the time they had that physical access to your machine. So where this is likely to be implemented most, it would be with more like nation state hackers or, say, law enforcement trying to gain access to an encrypted or a locked down system. So still a serious issue. Something that's probably not going to affect most of us on a day-to-day basis. A couple of things you can obviously do to keep yourself better protected: enable File Vault encryption, keep tabs on and control of your Mac at all times, and don't plug in any untrusted cables or devices. So as long as you know what's going on with your system, as long as you're in control of it, as long as you're taking care with what you're plugging into, you know, don't plug into random USB cables that you find lying around, say, at a hotel room or something like that. Use your own cables, make sure everything has been within your control, and you probably won't be impacted by this vulnerability. And as we would expect, Apple's probably going to patch it, or I would say definitely will patch it, in future updates of their products. Finally, in the news for this week, one little quick bit of news. This one coming from Phoenix, Arizona, or really from Apple and Apple Maps. And I am so jealous of this one. As you know, I am a fan of Apple Maps Look Around. I think it's an amazing technology. It's Apple's Street View-like technology. I think it's far superior to what Google has on their platform. It's been being rolled out in a number of areas, and I guess this week it was rolled out to Phoenix, Arizona. So if you're in Phoenix, congratulations to you. This year, Apple has expanded it to a number of cities, including Chicago, several cities in Japan, and as we noted last week, London, Dublin, and Edinburgh over in the UK. So I'm hoping Apple can get it rolled out in a lot more cities, hopefully in 2021. Maybe there's even a few more left for 2020. If you do happen to catch it rolling out to your city, let us know about it. Maccast@gmail.com. We don't know when and how Apple's rolling it out or what the whole process is, but I'm still hoping San Diego is on that list sometime soon. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Look, whether you're working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions that allow you to take your project to the next level. Simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. And here is a cool thing, because listen, you can get started on Linode today with a $100, yep, that's right, $100 free credit for MacCast listeners. You can find all the details at linode.com/MacCast. So that should totally allow you to test out Linode, to try out all of their great products and services, and really get in there and set up the server you need. Again, whether it's for your personal project or something you're looking for your business. One of the ways that I use Linode is in my web development. It is really great for setting up instances and of servers, and using their available one-click apps makes it really easy for me to quickly set up and deploy development environments. I can easily set up the server with a LEMP or LAMP stack. I can set up tools like Docker or GitLab or Jenkins for doing deployments. And I can quickly and very easily set up with one click a WordPress environment. So I can have these environments to play around with. I can play around with different technologies, something I like to do a lot for my learning. And Linode is a great service to have for that. Of course, you can build your entire site on Linode. You can build multiple sites on Linode. It really is servers to do whatever you need them to do. And Linode has 11 global data centers, provides 24/7 365 human support with no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. And in addition to their shared and dedicated compute instances, you can use your $100 credit on things like S3 compatible object storage, managed Kubernetes, and even more. Visit linode.com/MacCast and click on the Create Free Account button to get started. That's linode.com/MacCast, linode.com/MacCast. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the show. Last time on the show, we mentioned that some listeners and some people in the Mac community have been kind of hit by a bug in either watchOS 7 or iOS 14. It's not really clear. It might even be something with iCloud, where some users, after upgrading to watchOS 7, iOS 14, lost some of their fitness and tracking data, specifically GPS data around routes for, you know, runs and workouts and cycling workouts and all that sort of thing. So something very upsetting and disturbing. And unfortunately, it sounds like longtime listener and contributor to the MacCast, Gary, also got hit by this. And here's what Gary had to say.
Hey, Adam, Gary. I wanted to just send in a voice message regarding my experience with Apple Watch and Apple as of late. I just got off the phone with Apple regarding data loss from within the health and fitness, which formerly was activity. Ever since Apple Watch 4, now upgrading to Apple Watch 6, a lot of my data seem to have gone missing after iOS 14, and you would lose chart information for your heart rate, no GPS information for your runs or walks. Some of the heart rate information in various charts that were there was missing half the data. I did the troubleshooting steps that Apple suggested for data moving forward and possibly a restoration of the data from the past. And after speaking to them today, they said there was no guarantee of any of the data from your historical to be restored, and basically kind of is what it is. I really felt like, you know, it's like a stomp on the face or whatever, punch in the gut, because you spend so much time kind of perfecting your run or working on your activity and using that data to kind of help improve your fitness and look at that historical data that is valuable to you. And in thinking about their relationship with health and how they're wanting to position themselves more and more as a place to store that information and maybe use it with your doctor to help give more data and background. If it's just a matter of the next point update or the next update to an OS that you basically lose your data and there isn't an avenue to restore, it seems like we're missing something here. Not so great. Maybe Apple doesn't really think about the fitness or activity area as much as maybe if it had affected directly the health app. I did mention the same data was missing from health, or various information discrepancies, and they didn't have a path to restore that either. I'm really hopeful that another point update, maybe 14.2, might restore some of this, but it doesn't sound likely. So thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary. Sorry you're going through that. And yeah, that kind of stinks, right? You would hope that we could trust Apple to really keep that data secure. I'm a little bit more positive on this. I have been hearing rumors that Apple's engineers are aware of this issue with some users, that it potentially is something on the iCloud side. I'm thinking maybe something related to the encryption keys and maybe just not getting access back to that data. Hopefully it's not something as severe as data corruption, but yeah, it is definitely disturbing. You know, Apple has sort of said they're going to take responsibility for this data, or given the impression at least that they would take responsibility for this data. The reality is though, I think if you read the terms of service, I'd have to go back in and look, but it would not surprise me to find out that they don't have any responsibility for this data whatsoever. If you read, you know, again, these terms of services probably say that you're supposed to be backing up your own stuff, which you absolutely can do. And it's something we've talked about on the show here. You know, as much as I love and trust Apple, I would never trust them wholly and completely with my data. I just don't. I always presume even stuff that's stored in iCloud, even stuff in my iCloud photo library, all of that stuff I assume could go away at some time if I'm not backing it up myself. And we probably don't think too much about this health and fitness data. And I probably think that there are a lot of people in our community that maybe don't even know how they can back it up or that they can back it up themselves. And so, you know, I think that we should probably cover that a little bit. And I don't know that this would particularly help out in this situation. Maybe it's the same issue with the backed up data locally. I would hope not. But at least if you had some backups, you might have the opportunity to potentially restore that data. Now, according to Apple, what should be happening is if you sign in with your Apple ID, the health and fitness information in the Health app and in your account should be automatically stored in iCloud. And it is encrypted to and from iCloud and also encrypted inside iCloud. So technically, Apple should have a backup. And that's kind of what gives me hope that maybe their engineers can figure out how to restore this. Because if there is backups and it is just some sort of issue either with encryption or data corruption, they can probably solve that, like you said, with a point release. But as far as taking control of this data yourself and backing it up, you can manually make a backup of your data. Now, the important thing to note here is that in order to back up really sensitive data, like password data, like your Apple keychains, or in this case, your health data, you need to turn on encryption in your backup for backing up on your Mac. It's not too hard to do, but you do need to set up a password, and you are going to have to remember that because you won't be able to restore without it. So to do this, all you need to do is connect your iPhone to your Mac. So easiest way to do this, of course, is through the Lightning cable and plug that into the USB or USB-C on your Mac, physically connect it. That's going to be a faster transfer. You can probably do it over Wi-Fi if you have Wi-Fi setup enabled. If you're on a newer version of the operating system, you're going to connect your phone. You're going to look in the Finder, look in the sidebar. You should see the phone icon. You can select it there. This would be the same procedure if you're on an older OS. You just use iTunes for it, right? So plug it in, open up iTunes, and in the sidebar, you should see your iPhone icon. Click on that icon, and then you want to go to the General tab. And in the General tab, you want to make sure you check on Encrypt Local Backup. If you've never set it up before, it's going to ask you to set up a password. Make sure you pick a good secure password. And like I said, do not forget it. I think it does give you the option to save it into your keychain. So you probably want to do that if given the option. Also, I would say if you use a password manager, put it in there as well and keep it nice and safe. You will need that if you ever need to restore. But once that's turned on, you can then click the Backup Now button, and that should create a local backup of all your data, including your health and fitness data. Now, if you're using iCloud backups and you're doing everything automatically, you will have to remember to maybe come in and do your own, you know, backups manually every once in a while. Great thing to do is set up a recurring reminder either in the Reminders app or in your calendar, and just maybe once a week or even once a month, you know, depending how frequently you want to make sure your data is backed up, come in here and just do this procedure. Connect your phone to your Mac, click the Backup Now with the encryption enabled, and that will give you a backup of all that data. So at the very least, if this happens again and Apple screws up all your data, you have a chance maybe at recovery. And I would even say, you know, these backups get stored locally on your Mac. So if you have other backup solutions on top of this, something like Time Machine, or even better yet, an offsite backup with a place like Backblaze, then that's going to be double backup of your data. And now you're in control and you're not relying wholly on Apple. And I know that can maybe be hard to hear for folks who might have lost data recently because of this issue. It can be definitely frustrating, and I certainly feel your pain, but maybe this is a good time to kind of take a check and learn from that experience and start taking control of your own data. You should always be in control of your own destiny, in my opinion, and backup is a big part of that. And I know we've talked about this a lot on the MacCast. Just a few other things with this procedure. If you want to verify that you do have the local backup, you can click the Manage Backups button in that General tab, and it will show you all your previous backups. It'll show you the date and time that you did those backups. And if you ever do need to restore, just simply connect your phone, come to the same tab, click the Restore Backup option. You'll be able to select your previous backup. You will need to enter that encryption password, so grab that from your password manager or get it from the keychain, and then you can do a restore of your own data. So hopefully that helps out a little bit for a few of you out there. Hopefully, again, Apple gets this resolved and it's not an issue of full data loss, especially for you, Gary. I hope you don't lose that, because I'm totally with you. Like, that is valuable data. It's data that you've collected. It's very personal data, and we feel very connected to it, right? Because it's our health. It's our information. And for Apple to kind of be, I don't want to say cavalier, because I don't think that was what they're intending. You know, with technology, things can happen, and that's why we want to have backups. So, you know, unfortunately, they may have dropped the ball on this one a little bit. I think that's maybe the way to put it. And hopefully we can recover from it. But only time will tell. Hopefully we'll have some good news on a future episode of the MacCast. Another thing that came up this past week, and this was something that I'd covered back on the MacCast. You know, I lose track of time. I thought I had talked about this pretty recently, but it turns out it was way back in December of 2018. But I had a question pop up. I can't remember if it was via email or via the Patreon Slack channel, but someone had asked me about playlists and the podcast app, and basically the podcast apps, Apple's podcast app, and its lack of playlists or the ability to create playlists. And while that is true, they technically don't have quote-unquote playlists, they actually do have a feature that behaves, in my opinion, exactly like playlists. They just call it something different, and they specifically call it stations. And so if you'd like to kind of create a curated list of podcasts and episodes and kind of mix them together and to be able to control the play order and how you consume them and how many you download and those sorts of things, you can do that with the stations feature in the podcast app. And I kind of feel like this is a little bit of an unknown feature, because it comes up every once in a while and people are often surprised when I tell them about it. So wanted to bring it up again here on the show. You can actually create multiple stations and then filter and sort shows in a number of different ways. So it is a really pretty cool feature if you've never played around with it. And I would encourage you really to go in and to check it out. So what you do is you go into the library section of your podcasts, and then you can create and edit stations by tapping the edit link. So go into library, tap on the edit link in the upper right-hand corner, and then you should see an option for creating a new station. And then you can give that station a name, and then you are given several options to set up for how you want to control that station. One is the play option. This is the order that they will display and play in, and you have a bunch of different options that you can do there. You can choose to group by podcast. So if you want the filters applied by each podcast individually, you can kind of group them together. You can set up the episodes, which includes, you know, how many of the most recent episodes do you want to show in your station. You can choose the media type. So if you want to filter to just video podcasts or just audio podcasts or have a mix of both, you can do that. There is the unplayed only toggle. So if you want your station to only show unplayed episodes, episodes you hadn't listened to yet, you can do that. You can toggle that option on. And then finally, the podcasts, which is where you will go in and select the individual shows that you want to include in this station. So I kind of look at this as sort of creating your own RSS feed for your podcasts. You really can kind of mix and match and put different podcasts together. You can put them around topics. You can, you know, create stations however you want. You can create as many stations as you want, and then you can access them once they're set up under the library tab. And I personally have a few different stations set up. I have like one just for my Mac podcasts, so I can separate that from my other shows. I have some for my favorite podcasts, and I have one that is just filtering down the most recent episode of each podcast in my library. And it's really great for having those options when you want to go in and listen to shows. You can also override and kind of control, or I guess make stations have different rules than the default settings that you might have for individual shows. And so that's pretty cool. And kind of related to that, I thought I should kind of mention how you can control the default settings of your shows. Because this is another feature I think that many folks don't know about in the podcast app. So if you go into, again, the library tab, but this time tap on shows, you can select the show you want to set up the settings for, and then tap the dot, dot, dot button in the upper right-hand corner, the ellipses button, and then tap on settings. And then you can change the options to custom settings, and that would allow you to control things like the episode order, the number of episodes that get downloaded, whether or not you want to delete played episodes. You can limit the number of episodes. You can even control the refresh frequency for individual podcasts. So if you have a podcast, you only want to have it check for new episodes every week versus every day, you can adjust that setting. So, you know, I know that Apple's podcast app can sometimes get a lot of flack as being too basic, but there are some pretty cool features in there if you want to just get in and do a little bit of digging. One of the things that I like to do is I prefer sorting oldest episode to newest episode rather than newest to oldest, which I think is the default. And that's because I tend to fall behind on shows, but I do want to still listen to them in sequential order. But again, you can change all that stuff. If you prefer a manual order, you can set that up. If you prefer, you know, something different entirely, you totally have those options. So I hope this kind of exposes a new feature of the podcast app for you. And if you do like it, let me know about it. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Also, if you just have a general tip for the podcast app or anything else Apple or Mac related, tell me about that too. Shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Next up, I've got a couple of tips from a listener specifically related to using a Mac Mini and a eGPU and logging in. So here is what Dan had to say this week.
Hey, Adam, I discovered a couple things recently that started to make my life a lot easier, so I thought I would share them with you and you can decide if they might be helpful for the MacCast community. But quite a while back, you had a guest on who talked about the Mac Mini and how it was a really good option. And I've also been using a Mac Mini and have liked it, but it would bog down every once in a while. I do quite a bit of audio production, and I never thought audio would be very graphics demanding, but the eGPU I got has made a huge difference. I got the Sonnet EGFX Breakout Puck, I think they call it, but it works really well. But one of the annoying things with the Mac Mini is when you're using an eGPU and you go to log in, like sometimes you just need to restart your computer and you want to log in quick and get going again. But when you have an eGPU, you have to use a display that's plugged directly into the Mac Mini for logging in. And then once you're logged in, it'll start seeing the eGPU. Well, that's a pain in the neck, because in my case, I have to get behind the Mac Mini and change what cable's plugged in, and it's annoying. So I'm visually impaired, but I have partial sight, and so I kind of use some vision, but I often have VoiceOver running. And so I thought I would share this with the community in general, because of course, the Mac Mini reboots and I just have a black screen on my display, but I decided to just hit Command F5, which is the command that starts VoiceOver on the Mac. And sure enough, you have to hit it twice, Command F5, Command F5 again, and then it says username in a very old school voice. It's just for logging in, but it says username. And so if you're comfortable typing in your username just by touch, not being able to see it, then you hit tab and it says password, and you can type in your password and then you hit enter and wait, you know, a little bit, and then it'll start seeing the eGPU and your display will come on without having to monkey around with changing display inputs and stuff. So I found that really useful. I thought very few people would probably know about that, because they might not use VoiceOver and an eGPU. But it helped a pain point in my life. And then the other thing is, in the last episode, you mentioned how awesome it is to use the Apple Watch to unlock your Mac. And that had stopped working for me, and I missed that magical experience. And I had tried to figure it out several different times, couldn't figure it out. And then I finally found a solution. I mean, it tells you very clearly you need to have Bluetooth on. So I knew that. But what I finally discovered was stopping that function from working was that I had a little a dongle that plugs into a USB port and splits it into four more USB ports. I thought I had taken it out of the chain and tested, but maybe not. Anyway, as soon as I removed that splitter, basically, then everything got better. And I have a different one that I'm using, and that one works fine. But I guess it's just a reminder that when you're troubleshooting, make sure to systematically remove peripherals. And that was what was causing my problem. So, and I hadn't been able to find it anywhere online as I tried to troubleshoot it. So I thought I would mention that in case if people are having trouble getting their Apple Watch to unlock things properly, it might be a peripheral that who knows why is messing with the Bluetooth, because it wasn't a wireless thing. It was just a dongle. Anyway, I thought I would share those things. Hope they're helpful.
Hey, Dan, thank you. Yeah, I think both of those are very helpful tips. I will point out the Sonnet EGFX Breakaway PUC RX 560 is that eGPU. I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It runs about $300 US, so nice upgrade, I would think, for a Mac Mini or a MacBook, even if that's something you have, MacBook Air, something like that, something where you have a integrated GPU, and maybe you want more of a discrete GPU, something with a little bit more power. I think eGPUs are a really great thing to come to the Mac, and it sounds like it's helping you out. Obviously, there's a downside in terms of the monitor. I would think that maybe some folks have two monitors hooked up, so you have your primary and then your secondary on the eGPU. But if you're just using the eGPU, yeah, that would be real annoying for logging in. So it's good to know that you can quickly just use VoiceOver for that. And I think that is a great little workaround, and definitely something I wouldn't have known about without your tips. So thanks for sending that one along. Also, that tip about checking hardware when you're troubleshooting is a great one, because I do think we often think about software and the operating system causing issues, it being something like that, or something physical to the Mac itself, like a failing hard drive. But certainly something plugged into a port could be causing some conflict or some issues. So it always is a great troubleshooting step, and something I forget about myself, to kind of unplug everything and make sure there isn't something in that device chain that is just maybe doing something weird. And who knows why these things happen, but obviously they do. More often than not, I don't want to speak to the product that you bought specifically, but oftentimes I found that cheaper products, maybe we try to save a little bit of money with a USB hub or something like that and get a cheaper one than maybe more of a well-known name brand one or something we typically trust. They sometimes can have little quirks to them, and I think sometimes it's you get what you pay for, right? You're paying for maybe cheaper controllers, and maybe they're not as good as higher quality ones, and they just run amok and cause some sort of problem with your system that's unexpected, like interfering with your Bluetooth, even though it's not even anything related to Bluetooth. Who really knows? But glad you were able to troubleshoot it, and that is a great troubleshooting step. Sort of take everything out of the chain, plug things in one at a time. I've had similar issues. I've even done things like just replacing a cable. Sometimes a cable going bad can cause weird issues, or even just rearranging how my hard drives have been plugged into a USB hub has fixed things. Like I had issues where I would get hard drives that were constantly unmounting from my system, and they were all plugged into a USB hub. And just simply changing the order that they were plugged into on that hub seemed to resolve the issue. Who knows why? But just a little experimentation was able to get me to a fix, or at least stop the problem, which was enough for me. So I definitely appreciate you sending in your tip, and I think that will help out at least a couple people, probably several people in our community. So thank you for that. Here's a cool tip that came in from the MacCast Patreon Slack channel. If you are a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/MacCast, you can get access to our Slack channel where a bunch of us hang out and kind of help each other out and ask questions and just talk about and geek out on Apple and Mac things in general. I encourage you, if you'd like to support the show, to check out Patreon. We certainly appreciate all of our Patreon supporters here on the MacCast. But a question came up about, hey, how do you print from iOS Notes? And this actually illustrates an example of one of my pet peeves about iOS and how Apple kind of puts things together in general on iOS, and that's that they can often create some very unintuitive user interfaces on iOS. I don't know why this happens, but it definitely does. We've talked about hidden interfaces, and you know, you kind of have to know specific things, and this is definitely one of those examples, because it seems like a simple question, right? How do I print from Notes? And you would think it was a simple answer, but it turns out it wasn't. And the answer did come from Grumpy in the MacCast Patreon Slack. And apparently what you have to do is you just have to open up the note. You have to tap on the dot, dot, dot in the upper right-hand corner. And then in the menu that comes up, where normally you would expect to just see the share sheet or the share option, you don't see that. What you do see, though, is a option that says send a copy. Yep, send a copy. And if you look, the icon that's associated with that is the share sheet icon. So sure enough, if you tap on that, it brings up the standard share sheet panel, which many people know that's where the print option is. So that'll bring up the standard panel. You can get access to the printing option. You can also, you know, get access to the copy link option, the send to AirDrop option. All of your standard sharing options are under that, but it is labeled as send a copy, which I don't think is really all that intuitive. So there you have it. That's how you print from iOS Notes. And a big thanks to Grumpy in the Patreon Slack for sharing that tip with us and passing it along to the community, because I personally never would have found it. And I saw the question and I couldn't even find the answer because I looked through there and I didn't see it. And it was there staring me in the face, but I had no idea. So why Apple does this, I don't know. There's a lot of options like that in Photos. This is another app where they've hidden a lot of things under the share menu, and you wouldn't think that's where those things are. Like, I think under there is like how you show and hide photos in the Photos app, along with some other options. Like, I think when you're trying to do or recognize if someone's face for the faces feature is in a photo, I think the manual options for that is under the share sheet icon as well. And I think in the Photos app it's still called share when you access the menu, but I'd have to go back and check because it's been a while since I looked. So Apple, kind of stop doing that. Can we standardize on some of this stuff so that it's not so confusing? Yeah, that would be a good thing. And then finally, for this week, I received an email from Robert. And Robert lives in an area where the cellular signal from AT&T, which is the service he uses for his iPhone, is really not the greatest. And of course, a great option for working around this is to enable Wi-Fi calling, which allows you to make phone calls over your wireless network. But unfortunately for Robert, he was saying that the signal is just barely strong enough, like one bar, that the iPhone, no matter what, chooses to use the weaker cellular signal over using the Wi-Fi calling signal. So his question was, is there a way to force the iPhone to prefer Wi-Fi calling over the weak cellular signal? And I looked into this a little bit. I actually don't know of a way to specifically do that, at least not automatically. The only thing I could come up with and think of was really sort of a workaround. And that would be to basically turn off cellular and force it to use Wi-Fi. Now, just in case some of you don't know how to enable Wi-Fi calling for your device, it's pretty simple. To turn it on, you just go into settings, you tap on cellular or phone, and then select Wi-Fi calling. And then you turn that on with the little toggle switch. It may ask you to set up your emergency address and emergency information, and then you can just tap on enable, and then you should have Wi-Fi calling turned on your device. And like I said, the way the feature works is if you ever have a weak signal or no signal for cellular, it will be able to use your Wi-Fi to place and receive calls. Now for Robert, the workaround that I could think of was to turn off cellular in Control Center. Now you don't want to just turn off cellular data, you actually need to turn off the cellular to get this to work. And the way I found or figured out how to do that was to go into Control Center, tap on the airplane mode button, which is going to turn everything off, all of your radios, and then just simply turn Wi-Fi and Bluetooth back on. So you'll have Wi-Fi connectivity, you'll have Bluetooth connectivity, you just won't have cellular connectivity. And then at that point, you can use the Wi-Fi calling, or your device will use the Wi-Fi calling. So for incoming calls, it'll just kind of happen automatically. For outgoing calls, you can either use your contacts database, and then you want to use the FaceTime calling feature, and that will allow you to place phone calls over Wi-Fi, over the Wi-Fi calling, rather than trying to go through the cellular network. And Robert did confirm that that sort of hack around, that workaround did work for him, but he's still very much interested in finding more of an automated option. The only other suggestion that I had would be to get a micro cell from AT&T or from your carrier. A lot of times if you complain about poor coverage in your area, you can even get them to give you a micro cell for free. They tend to cost a little bit of money. Although Robert said that AT&T had stopped supporting microcells when Wi-Fi calling became a thing. So he said, yeah, I had one of those, but AT&T doesn't support it anymore. And I actually have one for T-Mobile because I'm on T-Mobile and the coverage at my house wasn't all that great. And it works awesome. I plugged mine in. So what a microcell is it basically creates your own little mini cellular tower in your house, and you connect it to your Wi-Fi network, and it creates a strong 4G cell signal. So in my house, I now have full bars where I only had 1 to 2 bars before. You know, it's a workaround. Obviously, you'd hope your carrier would provide, you know, full coverage in your area, but it's not always possible. So microcell was a great way to go. I was shocked to hear that AT&T doesn't support them anymore. I don't know why they wouldn't, especially when, you know, they can't have coverage everywhere. So, you know, that was another option. But Robert still kind of looking for a way to automate or set up the phone to prefer Wi-Fi calling over cellular. Like I said, I couldn't figure out a way, but maybe one of you folks in our community know a clever way of doing this. If you do, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen, both for the Mac and for iOS. You can get more information and details on their software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or find me on Instagram, MacCast, on that platform And with that, that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.